Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live, weekdays, noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. Our first guest today is Dennis Edney. He is a lawyer, a Canadian lawyer, representing Omar Khadr, former Guantanamo inmate Omar Khadr. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Dennis?
I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us on the show today. Very important subject here. The website is freeomar.ca, freeomar.ca, and we have 2 10-minute segments with a break in the middle here, so should be plenty of time. If you could please, sir, can you tell us just first of all, who is this kid? How is it that he ended up in the custody of the American terror warriors?
Well, he was the only child in Guantanamo Bay, and he ended up there because his father had come to Pakistan and then had left Canada to go to Pakistan and then Afghanistan to work as an engineer. And when Afghanistan was invaded by the United States, the country, of course, was in turmoil, and many people sought safety in the mountain regions of Pakistan, including the Khadr family. However, Omar Khadr's father abandoned him and left him in the hands of a small group of Taliban warriors, promising to return and pick him up, and never did. And Omar was 15 at the time.
15 years old. And this is right at the beginning of the war in 2001. And so then what happened?
Well, the compound he was in was attacked by the U.S. forces. It was bombed and reduced to rubble. Omar was the sole survivor. And when the dust settled, a Delta Force soldier going by the pseudonym OC-1 stated he saw Omar crouched on his knees facing a blank wall, screaming from the bombing and shrapnel that had just permanently blinded him in one eye and had caused all kinds of damage to him. And then the officer shot Omar twice in the back. Omar was not expected to live. He regained consciousness 3 days later at the U.S. Naval Base in Bagram, Afghanistan. And from that moment, Scott, little Omar realized that his life had changed forever. He suffered extensive horrors of abuse and torture in Bagram, and whatever happened to him in Bagram continued in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo.
All right, well, I guess let's take it chronologically here just for ease's sake.
Sure.
Back to the battle, I guess there's a documentary about this, You Don't Like the Truth, which people can find at scotthorton.org/documentaries. I have it embedded in there for you. You Don't Like the Truth. The story of Omar Khadr. And I can't remember if it's from that or what I've read in other times, but I seem to remember that the shooting where he was shot in the back, as you described, that was early or kind of maybe midway through the firefight, and that he was found basically, as you say, it was assumed that he would die. He had been found in a pile of rubble from the battle, and this seems like it would contradict the charges against him, which actually sound a lot more like a scene from an old episode of the A-Team or something than something that could have actually fit with the circumstances of what we really know happened at that firefight. So in a sense, we're skipping ahead to the charges, but the charges are based on what they claim he did there. And I just wonder whether they're, you know, I know you're his lawyer, but can you tell us that story? Can you concede any part of what they accuse him of doing there?
They accused him of throwing a hand grenade that killed a Delta Force soldier called Christopher Spear. And Christopher Spear's team leader, for lack of a better description, who went by the pseudonym OC1, gave evidence at the so-called Guantanamo trial in the military commissions. And he didn't see Omar do anything. And what he did talk about was that he saw Omar was not part of the battle and was screaming, as you say. And that when he had shot Omar and left this alleyway, there were other soldiers, not regular soldiers, who were following behind him, and hand grenades were being thrown all over the bloody place. And he never, ever, he's the only eyewitness to Omar Khadr, and he can't point out that Omar Khadr threw a hand grenade. In fact, what he did say was that after leaving Omar, having shot him twice in the back, the hand grenade came soaring over him. And he felt that, and he believed there was another person alive at that time. But if you consider the reality of it all, having shot someone twice in the back and leaving them for dead, it's highly likely, if not impossible, that that young boy was able to get up and throw a hand grenade, and certainly in the distance that would have been required. Mm-hmm. And so it was a fabrication.
Well, and who said he threw it?
Pardon?
It sounds like you're saying the state's witness is debunking their case against him. But who claimed that he actually threw the grenade?
Ah, well, that's the best part. I don't know if I should use that phrase, the best part. When Omar, from the moment Omar gained consciousness, he was interrogated by a military officer called Sergeant Claus. And Sergeant Claus, from the moment Omar gained consciousness, tortured him to acknowledge that he had thrown a hand grenade that killed Christopher Speer. And under torture, Omar, of course, admitted to that, as one would admit to anything. And Claus is a particularly interesting guy because he was convicted for having killed two detainees in Bagram using the torture techniques that he used on Omar and crippling two others. And Claus was then charged and it was deemed that he was charged and given a 6-month sentence for assaulting these people that he had killed. And Claus gave evidence that he was harsher on this 15-year-old boy than he was on with adults. And so it was under torture by this horrible man who he interrogated Omar 32 times in Bagram Hospital, including hanging him from the door, being made to stand on his toes, all kinds of humiliating treatment. In fact, you know, a former U.S. Army medic gave evidence that he found Omar chained to the door frame of a 5-foot square wire cage with his arms suspended above his shoulders, hooded and weeping. And so that's the nature of the evidence that was provided about Omar Khadr.
That's all they had on him was his.
That's all they had on him.
His self-incrimination under torture, which you know that's why the Fifth Amendment is the Fifth Amendment here in the United States, for just those kinds of things. But anyway, I think it's just trivia at this point because. If he did throw the grenade, like they claim, from his tortured testimony, then I wonder, Dennis, whether you've ever heard of any international law that would make that a war crime for a civilian to defend himself from an invading military force by throwing a grenade at them. What the hell is a war crime about that? I mean, obviously what they did to him from that moment on is all war crimes, but we'll get back to that in a second.
Well, I remember Dick Cheney.
Oh, no, and now the music's playing. You know what? I'm sorry. I'm terrible at this. Hard break. We got to take a break. We'll be right back, and I'll let you get to that about the charges against him, the allegation of the thing that he didn't do or whether that would be a war crime anyway, and then we'll get back to efforts to free him and the rest. It's Dennis Edney. He's the lawyer for Omar Khadr, innocent victim of the American Empire. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horn Show here. I'm talking with Dennis Edney. He's a lawyer representing Omar Khadr, Canadian citizen. At 15 years old, his father abandoned him with some Taliban fighters. They were attacked by the Delta Force. A Delta Force guy died, and then they tortured this 15-year-old boy into confessing to a ridiculous story that couldn't possibly be true about him throwing a grenade and killing this guy that their own Delta Force witnesses on scene debunk even the possibility that this could have even happened. But then, I'm sorry, Dennis, at the hard break there, I was asking whether there's any conceivable circumstance where that would be a war crime, even if it was true.
Well, of course. Had Omar been guilty of throwing a hand grenade on a battlefield, he, at the age of 15, he was entitled to many international instruments or treaties that the United States and Canada have been are signatories to. And one is, of course, the signatory as being a child soldier. But he was never treated as a child soldier, even though he was 15 at the time. And even though David Crane, who was the U.S. special prosecutor on the Sierra Leone child soldier trials that were funded both by Canada and the United States in the millions of dollars, agreed that he was a child soldier. Canada and the United States were firm in the fact that they would not allow him to be thought of as a child soldier. You also have other instruments. Like
Wait,
the
when you say instruments, you mean protections. In other words, he's banned from being prosecuted for a war crime in a situation like that.
Yes, we give an international law. We have a different standard for children as opposed to adults. And so we have these various treaties that allow protection to our children. And the one is in particular countries where we have child soldiers that are put in these positions by authority figures, we give them protection. And we recognize that these are vulnerable individuals who, if were fully informed and dispassionate, would not be in those battlefields. And so Canada and also the United States, in dealing with the child soldiers in Sierra Leone, spent millions to rehabilitate child soldiers. And yet, Omar Khadr was not recognized as a child soldier. In fact, no international treaty was allowed to be provided to Omar Khadr in Guantanamo Bay, just as no Canadian consular official under the Consular Relations Act was allowed to come and visit Omar in Guantanamo Bay and provide assistance. And so Guantanamo Bay is well described as a place beyond the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, well, and before we get to Guantanamo, I wanted to get back to Bagram. In the documentary, You Don't Like the Truth, there's an interview with a guy, a gigantic prison guard-looking guy with monster tattooed across his chest, talking about how, admitting that he was the meanest torturer there, but during his shift, no one was allowed to mess with this kid because he's just a kid. So leave him alone. But then I believe he also goes on to say, but hey, that was only when I was on duty. When I wasn't on duty, there was a lot more going on. And we're not talking about, I guess, the top secret, highest level rendition program. We're talking about basically just regular prison guards and lower level enlistees in the army, military police and such, being told, go ahead and do whatever you want to these guys with no limit. And so it's kind of maybe hard in 2015 for people to think about the climate as it was back then and what was being taken out on the prisoners in Bagram in 2001 and 2002. But could you, at the risk of grossing everyone out, could you please elaborate on what exactly they did to Omar Khadr.
Well, I think you're talking about Damian Cassetti, first of all. And Damian Cassetti has reached out for forgiveness from Omar Khadr. Damian Cassetti will tell you that he was 20 years of age when he was on this torture team, supervised by Sergeant Claus. And he also says publicly that he was, that he said, we did terrible things to that young man. And so you have to understand that despite the fact that what we're talking about is a hospital, and despite the fact he was in the hospital, and despite the fact that this 15-year-old had just regained consciousness and was suffering from extensive shrapnel wounds all over his body, that the bones in his left shoulder and chest were shattered from bullet wounds, or that he was now partially blind, he would be taken into an interrogation room with his hands and feet shackled to a stretcher and leaving him to unable to resist the horrors that was going to be perpetrated on him by these torture individuals, this team. You know, and when the interrogators didn't like the answers they were given about Omar, they would put this man who's just come off the battlefield, gained consciousness 3 days later with all the sufferings I've just pointed out to you, and they would force him into stress positions, which is unnatural positions that would cause agonizing pain to this young boy. He would just end up screaming and sobbing. And when he reached that stage, while he's lying on his stretcher, it was then that his captors would then shine a bright pencil light directly into his damaged eyes, causing even more pain and even more damage. And when I referred that to, confronted Damien about that, that's when he said, you know, we did terrible things to that boy. And then as Omar became more mobile in the hospital, he would then be taken into the interrogation room with a black hood placed over his head, but the sole purpose of disorienting him. And what Omar describes, that he had this suffocating feeling as the hood was wrapped so tightly around his neck, nearly choking him. And so he panicked, this young boy, and he screamed to his interrogators that he couldn't breathe. And what would they do? They just laughed at him as they brought in barking dogs smiling into his face while he's covered with this hood. But, you know, probably more significant for me is the fact that he was a constant punishment, it was a constant technique, that he would be made this young boy, this young innocent boy, because I'm a father, that he would be made to stand on his toes in a crucifixion position for hours at a time, with his arms outstretched to the upper parts of a door jamb and hung by his wrist. And what happens is that eventually your weight, supporting your weight on your toes becomes an unbearable strain, and so your ankles and your feet will swell to at least twice their size, and you're in agonizing pain. And it was in those positions that Omar at times would then just urinate on himself, and they would then untie him, and they would use his head as a mop to clear up the urine on the floor. And while doing that, he would be threatened with rape and other humiliating acts, which I don't care to describe to you listeners. And there is support for that, because in Guantanamo, at the so-called trial, a former U.S. Army medic gave evidence that he once found Omar chained to the doorframe of a 5-foot-square wire cage, with his arms suspended, hooded and weeping. So imagine that frightening picture of a 15-year-old boy. Imagine your own child, your own brother and sister being treated that way. And you know, I interviewed a British Guantanamo detainee, and former British Guantanamo detainee in London, and he said, you know, we could hear Omar's cries and moans day and night until we separated from him. And we all felt bad for him. He was just so young. And here's another story for your listeners. I recall Omar telling me, because I drafted an affidavit for the Supreme Court of Canada, and I recall him telling me about the story of a U.S. soldier who would come to his bedside regularly, would drop his pants and stick his naked bum in Omar's face and then fart. And others around the bed would simply laugh for this antic. And so it's sickening, it's horrible, and what does it say about humanity?
All right, now I'm sorry. We have a very short time left. We got to move on to the bogus plea deal he was forced to accept. And then, you know, obviously the results is he was transferred to Canada, where now he's in, I believe, a regular prison, and there's a move to get him finally released. So in very little time, can you please address the bogus plea and the efforts to get him released?
Well, we don't have enough time. And Guantanamo, the story, the quality of representation that Omar received in Guantanamo was disgraceful. There were some great military lawyers who represented other detainees. Omar was not represented well. He had very inexperienced military lawyers, and it was very difficult for us civilian lawyers to be allowed to participate. No witnesses were called on his behalf or allowed in for his trial. I had everybody from the UN to David Crane from the Sierra Leone trials and so on and so forth, whom I was told would come as witnesses, were not allowed. And the, no self-defense was allowed, and no torture stories or evidence was allowed to be, it was accepted by the court. And so at some point, we received an offer that if he pled guilty to all these charges and all, and this statement of fact, that he could get out of Guantanamo, he'd get a sentence of 8 years with only 1 year to remain in Guantanamo and the 7 years back in Canada. And so Omar didn't want that deal. He wouldn't take that deal. And against all my training, I forced him. Because I told him, if you don't sign this deal, you'll spend your life in this horrible place. And so he did so. And then he was returned to Canada. But the Canadian government took an extra year before it came to allow him to come home, contrary to the agreement. And unfairly, the U.S. Pentagon, in providing status about Omar Khadr, told the Canadian government in writing, which I provided to them, that Omar was a compliant minimum security prisoner and a former judge advocate from Guantanamo also wrote a letter saying he's just a nice kid. But the Canadian government refused to listen to that. They classified him as a maximum security prisoner, a danger to Canada, and a danger to any prisoner in any Canadian prison. And so he ended up in a maximum security prison in outside Ottawa, spent the first 7.5 months in isolation, and then on the day that he was released, he was put on a food line to assist, and somebody tried to stab him. I then was able to have him moved to another maximum security prison near my where I live. And what did we do on arrival? We put him on this Muslim kid, we put him on a white supremacist unit, and the shit was kicked out of him all within 5 minutes. And so welcome to Canada. And so I have not lost a single case against this government in over 10 years in fighting for Omar Khadr. I was also successful, along with others, in the U.S. Supreme Court. But I'm also confronted with the limits of justice. When you're facing governments who are intractable and determined to do what they wish to do. And so Omar Khadr continues to remain in jail, and so I keep coming up with different ideas of trying to get him out. I'm back in the Supreme Court in May, and I'm also for the third time in Canada on Omar Khadr, but more importantly, I'm doing a bail hearing, which is quite unique. And that bail hearing requires, if I'm successful, a plan, a reorientation plan into society. And I have all kinds, and so on the public record, all kinds of established public figures who are prepared to step up and assist Omar in his reintegration back into society. Because they, like many of us, believe that what happened to Omar Khadr is a horror story. And not just for them, but for any of our children. Because whatever happened to Omar could happen to any of our children, any of us. So we bequeathed a terrible legacy for their future.
Well, listen, this is such an important thing, and he is so lucky that he's got a lawyer who knows what he's doing and willing to work so hard on this. So I want to encourage everybody, if you can, please go to freeomar.ca. That's how to donate to this cause, correct, Dennis?
Yes, yes, sorry.
I just want to make sure I wasn't giving everybody the wrong URL all of a sudden there. freeomar.ca. Listen, I've kept you over time, but thank you so much for giving us this time of yours this afternoon to talk with us about this absolutely horrible
case. No, thank you, and thank you, listeners, for being interested.
Thanks again. Talk to you another time soon, I hope. All right, y'all, that's Dennis Edney. The website is freeomar.ca if you want to help this campaign to, he's taking it to the Canadian Supreme Court to try to get Omar Khadr, this innocent victim of the terror war, released from prison. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.